Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom and welcome to Hashem. Thank you so much, God Almighty, for giving us the opportunity to broadcast, to talk your Torah, and to be here in Zion. And I'm not here alone. I'm here with you, God, but I'm also here with Rabbi Mike Foyer. Shalom and welcome.
Hello, shalom, Yishai. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm going to start with something a bit, a tad unsavory, but it is important. A few weeks ago, maybe a month or two ago, a wart started developing on the inner part of my left big toe. It turns out, you may not know this, but you need that part of your toe all the time.
I think I need all of my toes.
You do. You really do. But see, the thing is that you get to know how important your things are when they get a little bit hurt. And it's always amazing how this toe starts to bother you, and then your whole walk, your gait is off, and you can't run, and your touring in Hebron becomes harder, and just to get down on my knees to change my son Yisrael David is harder because I can't do that pivot, you know,
that moment of kneeling down, which is on
right,
your toes,
which is for a second you pivot onto your toes there. Okay, and why am I starting with this part of the show?
I was going to ask. Yes, thank you.
The answer is because I was thinking to myself, there is a scientific reason for this wart that developed on my toe, but there's also a spiritual reason. What is it? And I did a cheshbon nefesh, and I found all kinds of lacks in my personal character.
Spiritual warts,
lack in good characteristics, things that need to be worked on and fixed. And I thank the Lord. I thought about them and analyzed them and started the process of trying to rectify those things, become a better human being, and realizing that there's a wart on my soul, on the toe of my soul, S-O-U-L. In any case, why am I saying this? Because after I did that analysis, I thought to myself, but let me not stop there. Let me analyze if there's a pain in my nation that it's also manifesting in my toe. That I don't want to be hubristic, if that's a word. I'm not trying to say that I manifest
the pains.
You're
the embodiment of the Jewish
right,
people.
I'm not saying that, but I'm saying...
What is
a toe wart, if not a mnemonic, a reminder of something that you should be thinking about? So I thought about it, and I realized that for me, just for me, my toe is the Gaza Strip. Okay, my toe is the Gaza Strip. It's the, you know, down left part of my body, you know, and down in the left side of our country, down at the south
bottom left.
West, bottom left, there's a bad thing going on.
Oh, yeah.
A really bad thing. That thing is a sore. It is a sore. It is a hemorrhaging, pussy, just bad sore.
And it's expressive of all the bad decisions we've made over the last 100 years in returning to our land.
Yes, that, by the way, is the extra painful part of that sore.
Yeah.
I'm going to say something unnecessarily inflammatory, which is that it's one thing to deal with the Holocaust and the haters. It's one thing to be like, you hate me, and I want to survive, and I'm...
It's very clear. You're a Nazi,
clear.
I'm a Jew. We're right. Not going anywhere with this.
I love Goliath for that. Goliath is like, look, your God sucks. You guys are nothing.
Come on, bring it on.
Come on down, and let's fight it out, and whoever... Let the best man win. Let the best God win, okay?
Right.
Good enough. Now, the Nazis, they did a lot of hidden actions. They did a lot of... what's it called? In Russian, we call it maskarovka, you know, like tricky...
Psychological warfare,
propaganda, all that kind of stuff. So they weren't always so honest at all. Still, though, you knew who the Nazis were.
The cards were on the table.
Right. The cards were mostly on the table. The thing here, and so you faced the bad guy. You may have won one day, may have lost another day, but you were out there, and the cards were on the table, as you say. The thing with this is that what you just said adds another total layer of pain, which is retrograde motion, regressiveness, going back on our own successes, squandering your own wealth, your own blessings. That is an extra painful thing. Moreover, it hurts you from being able to take the next step because you lament that, you know, that you did this thing, so you sometimes end up trying to justify it, and you end up going back into those cycles without breaking out.
For sure. And also for me, and I don't know how far we want to go into this, but you know, if you look at the situation of so many human beings packed into such a small area, and how exactly did it come about? A lot of it has to do with, on one hand, this sort of almost unstoppable momentum of the Zionist project saying, listen, we're coming home. Oh, you happen to be in our living room? That's not going to work out so well for you, right? On the other hand, an inability on our part to accept that, to say, why? And if you look back at the history of Amba Artso, of the Zionist projects and us returning to our land and all the wars we fought, it's been very important to the Israeli psyche to see ourselves as the weak, right? And fighting against overwhelming odds and these sort of like, you know, vicious enemies. And the problem with that is that even though that may sort of assuage the moral conscience, especially the exile moral conscience, which intrinsically looks at the weak as morally superior, but it sets us up for a situation where, as is true right now, we need to be able to look at the Gaza Strip and say, yeah, you know, step one, step two, step three, yeah, we own that. Was it the nicest thing to do? Maybe not. Was it the best decision? Probably not. But that's what this is. Ah, but you know what? Step four, five, and six is going to take some real gvura. Like, it's going to take some clarity. It's going to take some courage. It's going to take some vision. And it might be brutal.
Moral clarity.
Moral clarity. Mm-hmm. Those are the decisions of the strong. Mm-hmm. And I see what's happening in the Gaza Strip right now as a testimony to our inability to release the need to be the weak and to step into our role as a people of power.
I think that the person who really set us down that path was Menachem Begin.
Yeah, you
think
so?
I think that he really was the person who, on the one hand, was a Gvuradik Zionist, but on the other hand, when the moment came of this peace kind of moment, he fell back into this mode of being accepted by the nations, accepted, there's going to be reign peace amongst us, and he forgot the Middle East code, he forgot who he was dealing with, and there were many signs, there were many, many, many signs, road signs along the way, if you read back the protocols, there's many, many road signs, but he was blinded by this place of trying to be an appeaser, and maybe enter into a kind of you know, Garden of Eden type of moment where peace has reigned supreme here in Israel, and he jumped the gun, I think.
Well, I want to find a time to duke that out, because you and I off air have sparred over the question of the peace with Egypt before, but for right now, I just want to like make a call for people to think, and whether you see yourself as empathetic to the Palestinians or whether you see yourself as a Jewish nationalist is irrelevant to me, right? There is a issue of human suffering here, the root of which, in my eyes, is our inability as a people to deal as the masters in our land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jew, I think that I would bring it down to a little bit more political terms, which is I find that the liberal mindset is such that it really, in the end, has a problem with Jewish power.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? It has a problem. It just cannot swallow it.
But just notice that the liberal mindset in the world has a problem with power at all.
Right. So here we go. Check this out. This happened to me last Shabbat. I was in Alon Moreh. It was awesome at the Shachar's house. It was wonderful. We had a great time. And I was on a lot of panels also. It was just a lot of fun. And it was
Wartnall.
Wartnall. I was limping through Alon Moreh, but it was, you know, but it was still so great to be there and just to keep looking at these twin mountains, Har Eval HaGrizim and Joseph's tomb down there in the middle, and seeing the Levites and the elders in the middle of the, you know, underneath the mountains and the six tribes, just being able to feel that it's very, very, those two mountains are very visceral. You can really, really.
They are sticking out there like, hey, right. Where did that come from?
Right. It's like, it's iconic. Okay. Any case, so it happened that a Kodesh Baruch Hu put this into my head, which is like this. There are three pillars to being pro-Israel, mm-hmm. in my mind. I came up with three major pillars. Here's one, the Tanakh.
Yeah.
Tanakh splits into two, either historical perspective of Tanakh, that's Ben-Gurion. I see the Tanakh. I'm not so interested in the God aspect of it, but the history of the Jewish people in this land, that's the Tanakh. Or the theological aspect of it, which you look at the Tanakh, you're like, God promised and God says, and again, we should do what God says. So the religious aspect. So that's theological. Now, the Tanakh has been generally undermined in the West and in the liberal world. But yes. I don't think people have read the Tanakh. They don't know the Tanakh. And it's certainly not, even if they've read it.
The ignorance and the undermining are two different things, but they go together.
Right. Meaning to say, it doesn't hold sway. Either they don't know it.
It's not perceived as the basis of Western culture any longer.
Yeah, exactly. So it's either not perceived that or it's not known. But in any case, it's not followed. It doesn't have PR value. It's
got negative PR value, right. Because most people see it as sort of this sort of medieval, like a backwards, anachronistic document.
Right. Okay, so there you go. So the Tanakh is like dead. Okay? 200 years ago, people at Harvard were reading Tanakh in like Hebrew. Okay, you said Israel. They knew the hero. Okay, so that's pillar number one. Pillar number two is nationalism, as in the Jewish people, like any other ethnic group, have a right to self-determination in their ancestral homeland. Okay,
right.
Simple enough. Okay, so nationalism, but wait, nationalism is not cool.
Well, you know, it depends on who you ask, but certainly on the global scene, there's some tension around
right,
the world.
And the liberal mindset, which is...
President Trump just declared himself a nationalist in
he
Texas.
He did, and he also said something about patriotism at the UN. It was very interesting, but okay, but he's President Trump. That's exactly the point.
Yeah.
Not everybody's in line with him, okay? Not only with him. And certainly Western Europe has eschewed...
It's a post-national world.
Post-national world.
Yes.
So you just knocked out the second pillar.
Mm-hmm.
And the third pillar is the Holocaust, as in this great horror that happened. We have to rectify that as a world, and we Jewish people have to say never again. Therefore, we have to protect ourselves. We have to create a protectorate, a safe haven.
Yeah.
But now that, A, the Holocaust is a long time ago, and B, Jews are strong, kavyachol, seemingly, and therefore you can't play the Holocaust card.
C, the world is tired of walking around feeling guilty about
right.
it.
That's right.
So psychologically what's happening now is the need to sort of like – project the evil of the Nazis onto the Jews in order that people can say, well, we can sort of be done with that guilt feeling because, see, they're no different than anybody
right.
else.
Okay, so those are the three pillars.
There they go.
You've knocked them out. And so now every person, you know, every regular people out there are like, so why Israel? I don't get it.
Yeah, for sure.
And I was thinking about what is the answer to that
Liberal
question?
Liberal Jews more than anyone else.
Right.
I would say that are vulnerable to that.
So I was thinking, what is the answer to this quandary? And my only answer was, we have to teach Tanakh, nationalism, and the Holocaust. Okay? Meaning to say, those values are integral values. P.S. Holocaust means, it doesn't mean like they did bad and we gotta, it means never let that happen again, and you have a Jewish self-defense is a value.
So I want to add one to that about what are the antidotes there is that, where are we trying to go? One of the things that the world lacks most right now is leadership.
Right.
Intellectual leadership, moral leadership, actual political leadership. Mm-hmm. And so one of the challenges that we as a nation state face, and it goes back to the place where I think I probably agree with you in your analysis of Begin and the treaty with Egypt, is that we've been a client state politically for too long. Right? And there's no way to show real moral and political and intellectual spiritual leadership if we've just unquestioningly tied our boat to the American ship. So therefore, trying to sort of like push our culture here in the land of Israel toward real leadership, what's the mission? Beginning to speak about Zionism not as a refuge or even a right, you know, in terms of the language that you use, but also as a goal. Like, we're a mission-oriented people, and trying to reawaken the sense amongst Jews of what's that mission. What's beautiful is that the mission's a universal mission. I mean, it's a particularist mission because we're the Jewish people and Am Yisrael, and that's our goal. But it's a universal mission. We're on a mission from God, to borrow a phrase. So therefore, everyone ultimately ought to be able to hear and buy into that picture. Like, I have this sense that the sort of nostalgia of return has run its course.
Mm-hmm.
You start talking to my students now about the Holocaust and like, thank God we're here, or, oh, you know, I use the phrase often in my teaching, like, oh, you know, any one of your ancestors 100 years ago, 150 years ago would have crawled on hands and knees to get here, which is mamish true. Mm-hmm. It doesn't speak to them.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't move me.
Right. So you're saying that to make it attractive again, it's got to have a grander vision.
Yeah. What are we trying to accomplish? Because it also, by the way, diffuses that Israel for what? Because, you know, the idea of Israel as a return or as a refuge at this point, American Jews, rightly or wrongly, say, like, but what do we need it for?
That's right.
You're making the situation worse for the Jews right now.
Right.
So, but my point is like, well, I'm going to get into that. Let's
it's interesting.
What we're trying to get to.
You just reminded me that I once sat at Eugene, not Kantorowicz, that's a different person, but it's all an economist who sits at, the name will come back to me, but he's an economist that sits in the prime minister's office, and I had a meeting with him one time. And he said to me, he's like, I have to reconstruct it, I didn't think about talking about this, but he said to me, Israel's always had a raison d'etre that makes a lot of sense to everybody, everybody's behind it. He's like, in the 40s, it was starting up the state and in gathering the exiles. In the 50s, No, 50s was in Gathering the Edges. 60s, he said, was the water carrier and the agricultural side, and then the 60s
Thrive
war.
To survive.
Thrive to survive. And then the 70s, what did he say? I don't remember what he said in the 70s, but then he started talking about the Ethiopian Aliyah.
No one had a raised actor in the 70s.
No, 70s was just party on. You know, he said the Ethiopians, and there was all the, and the, oh, the Russian Aliyah, he said that was the 90s, you know, and there was this big thing. We have to now, as a nation,
absorb
these, this million new people that came. And he's like, but right now we're out of it. We don't have it. I think, and I might be in my, you know, in my particular vision, but I think that the great mission of our generation right now is to do reverse policy course and undo the great tragedy of Oslo and that thinking. But I understand what you're saying, which is even that's not enough. You're saying it's got to have a greater a vision for Israel on the world stage.
But the two could work well together, because reversing that course is also offering a model to the world of how people can actually live together in a new model of malchut, a new model of kingship. Not necessarily speaking about a guy with a throne and a crown, but one of the great challenges that we face here in reversing the process of Oslo is Oslo's premise on the notion that the only legitimate existence for a people that claims itself to be a people is in a nation state, right? And this just simply doesn't, the math does not work. You know, I mean, when you really get people to be honest here in the region, what it boils down to is that the Israelis aren't willing to give what the Palestinians want. The Palestinians aren't willing to accept what the Israelis are willing to give. So, like, why are we going round and round and chasing our tail as if the only solution is to divide up this pie into, like, ever more small and sophisticated chunks? So why don't we pull back the vision and say, wait a minute, what really needs to happen here is we need to survive and thrive, right? Everybody. I'm talking about everybody. What does that look like? What does sovereignty look like in that terms? Who really needs to hold the keys militarily, territorially, culturally, you know? And by the way, how broad do we cast the vision? How much does that have to do with the borderline failed states that are surrounding us? You know, like starting to question a lot of the premises that came out of the world of World War II, the idea that that only the nation state is a viable model for world government, not dismissing the nation state as a model, but beginning to think creatively. That's the stuff that has to happen. So therefore, reversing the Oslo process can actually offer new models for the world as a whole.
Interesting. Very interesting. Okay, so let's shift gears and let's talk about the
you started with the wart.
That's right, with the wart. That's right. With the wart of war, okay? Not the name of the show. Let's talk about the archetype of a catalyst for change, and that is Abraham. The catalyst for change, the guy that makes things change,
father of Hebrew consciousness.
That's right, father of Hebrew. And just I think even we'll deal in just a few minutes with one of the most revolutionary modes of connecting with the creator of the world. We'll deal with that in a second. So Torah portion is Vayera. It's in Genesis. It starts in chapter 18. The Bishop of Canterbury correctly started at verse 1 there, and basically, I mean to say that the chapter division is like our tradition, Masoretic tradition as well, of divisions in this case. And anyway, so famously, Abraham is sitting in Hebron, actually in Elonei Mamre, which is a hill up in Hebron, and called today Ramat Nimra. It's right. It's right above the Marat Machpelah. It's just a few minutes away, and he is, according to the Midrash, just recovering from circumcision surgery
at age 99.
At age 99, he sees three people coming. He's very excited. He wants to feed them because that's what he does. And the Midrash waxes a lot about how much he is so concerned with being a host for guests, and how much he is really, as we talked about it last week, a preacher and a man who set up shop as a minister,
yep,
to teach people, and
even an evangelist.
And he feeds them, and it turns out that these three angels are not three men are not just Arab
wanderers
or merchants, but rather, in fact, they are angels. And that's, you know, the first that he feeds them, and then in between here, it says that he runs to the flock, and he gets their three bulls, or not bulls, calves.
Calves, yeah.
Calves, and he slaughters them in order to, the Midrash says, in order to give them each the tongue.
It's proof that it was an Ashkenazi that wrote the Midrash.
Why is that?
Because he serves them tongue.
With mustard.
With mustard. That's what Rashi says, right. Yeah.
That's right. And I think the meaning of the Midrash is that he bids them to speak. Speak. Like, you have what to say, so say it. Like, there's a saying that's happening here. They are come here to tell him. They're coming here to announce something to him. And he's like,
here,
open your mouth.
Have a tongue.
Have some tongue. And they say to him, famously, they say to him, basically, they're here on two separate missions. One is to first tell him, hey, your wife's, where's Sarah? Oh, she's in the tent. Well, guess what? We're coming back from, and a year from now, you're going to have a son. And in this point, Sarah laughs. The laugh of Sarah.
Scoffs even.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, I want to
challenge the Midrash?
No, I just want to be kind to the matriarch Sarah and just say, okay, so she laughed. You know, God says to her, she's like, she denied it. She laughed. God said, you laughed. But he could have been said in a different way. She could have been like, I didn't laugh. He's like, yeah, you did laugh.
Yeah, come on. You know, I was listening.
Right. It doesn't have to be so harsh.
It's, because it's hard to buy.
It's just there's no real punishment that comes with her laughter. But here's the question. What is the deal? And here's, I really wanted to ask you this today. What is the deal with Isaac and laughter? When we meet Isaac, he ain't such a laughing guy, right?
No, he's fairly serious.
He's fairly serious.
And you can imagine that after he was bound to an altar by his father and almost slaughtered, it didn't get any more lighthearted.
Right. Or maybe it did. Maybe he was like, I've seen, you don't even know what I've seen.
Although we know that Yitzchak and Rivka Ishto, that he's the one who's seen playing with his wife.
That's right.
So what was your question?
My question is, what's the it's like a moment of Jewish comedy. It's like, you're gonna have a son. This son is your continuation, and I want you to call him Laffy Taffy. It's like, what's the deal? You know,
yeah.
Why is this name Yitzchak so important? That we're told twice, and we're told twice also about Ishmael, right? And that he's going to be called Ishmael.
Sure.
What's this name? And Ishmael, that's a serious name. God will hear.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is this name that the great continuer of Abraham is called? You know, the laugher. He shall laugh. She laughed. Or this memory of laughter. What's the big deal of that?
So, it's a great question, and off the bat, what I would say is you know, where does laughter come from? What makes us laugh? Most often, humor is rooted in the juxtaposition of two things that you never expected to see together, right? As soon as I say to you the phrase, a horse walked into a bar, you're already like, what? Come on. You know, so the power of juxtaposing two things which you don't expect to see together, first of all, is the root of Yitzchak's existence. And that's why Sarah laughs. She looks at herself. She says, I'm, you know, over 80 years old. My husband is not young, you know, and you're telling us I'm going to have a baby? And you put those two things together, it's incomprehensible. But laughter, as opposed to sort of skepticism, is the way in which we're able to hold two mutually incompatible things, which opens out potentiality as opposed to shutting it down. But that's why there's a fine line, and that's why the Midrash goes into this difference between Avraham's laughter and Sarah's laughter, with all due respect to our Holy Mother, that there's two potential ways we can psychologically, that we can relate to things we do not expect to see together. We can diminish them and say, no, they don't actually really belong together, and the very fact that you tried to put them together shows your incompetence and ignorance. Or we can have this sense of freedom. And think about it. Like, you ever said the phrase, I need a good laugh?
Sure.
Like, why? There's a shichur, there's a freedom that comes with laughing, which steps out of the confines of the world as you know it. And that's precisely what Yitzchak is. Remember, he is the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham, right, that he exists outside of the stars, outside of the whole framework of the ancient world, where Avram looked up at the stars and said, I will never have children. God, that's true. Avram will never have children, but watch this. I'll pull you outside of that whole framework. I'll call you Avraham, and I'll set you on a path that Am Yisrael and the Jewish people are pursuing to this very day, which is we don't fit the system.
I just want to stop there for a second and give people a little bit, our listeners. First thing, I don't think I mentioned the Land of Israel Network, which hosts us here. Thank you so much. You've broken through all boundaries, Land of Israel Network. Thank you so much.
Get out there and gird your loins, people.
That's right. Gird your loins, or we'd like to say tloin, which is the Land of Israel Network. So thank you very much. Where was I going? I was going
to
say...
You wanted to provide our listeners with something.
Oh, yeah. So there are some sins that we're told nothing can basically cleanse them. And I saw, I think it was a Rabbi Nachman phrase where he said, yeah, you cannot cleanse those sins. So the way to beat them is to just become a new person. Mm-hmm. That's the way to do it. Like, exactly, like add a hay. Like just become not who you were yesterday. And Rabbi Nachman was very famous for believing that you could just start again. And famously, he one day started 17 times again, you know? Mm-hmm. And he, you know, just the ability to kind of restart your life. And I think that's what we learn here. Okay, so that's, I think that's a great point of Yitzchak. And there's a great, I guess, it's not levity, but it is a lightness, a release.
A lightness of being, which is rooted in the sense that I'm not bound by the situation as it appears.
Right. Okay, so just because Judaism is so fun and cool, and I want to get back to that theme when we get to Sodom and Gomorrah. a great thing is like, and this is where I think Judaism just beats the other traditions, biblical understanding by hands down. And that is, you know, Abraham runs into Sarah's tent, says to her, bake bread. And then he offers them food. The bread is never offered. Where's the bread?
Right.
Where's the bread? Rabbis are like, at that moment she menstruated. And therefore the
bread was ritually impure.
Ritually impure. She couldn't serve it. It's like too good. It's like I said make the bread. The bread didn't come out. Where's the bread? Oh, she menstruated, meaning to say she became young again.
Yep.
You know, it's just a beautiful touch. In any case, another interesting touch is that the angels are three. And then they become two. Where's the third angel? Well, he's done.
Right.
He did his deal. And,
task complete.
That's right. And our rabbis teach us that, and the sages teach us, and Midrash tells us that basically angels are sent down for one task at a time. And they don't multitask. They are not multitaskers.
Just
okay?
Like you and I.
That's
we
right.
Pretend.
That's right.
That's because the essence of how they understood an angel is an angel, the word malach in Hebrew means a messenger. And an angel has no independent existence. They are just an embodiment of divine intention. So therefore, once that intention is complete, its embodiment has reached its fulfillment and ceases to be.
Right.
There's no independent existence there.
Right. I think there's also a focus lesson there, which is like,
yeah.
You know, you got your task. Get that thing done all the way. Get it done. When you're done with that, you let it, you know,
I do want to point out in terms of your competition with other ways of reading the Bible that what you're pointing out here is that our sages related to text as texture. Right? Meaning what you're noticing what we call lacune in the text. Like, oh, there's something that was there and then it disappeared. But that's not an accident or a throwaway. It means that when I run my eye over the text, that's a point of texture. Like, wow, there's a gap there. And I feel it. And so therefore, it's posing a question. It's offering answers. And that's how our sages, whose eye was like a scanning electron microscope when they related to the texture of the text, were able to draw out such depth of meaning and richness.
Right, and there are many other layers as well.
Many.
And it just, you know, the Ramban, for example, says at the beginning of the whole commentary in the Bible, it's like the whole thing is God's names. It can be combined and recombined. There's endless secrets within it. And we're dealing on only a certain superficial level, maybe a little deeper. Any case, so the two angels that are left are going down to do and here's my analysis of it, which is, they're doing a throwback to the Noach Torah portion. Okay, they're about to destroy the world for those towns. I think it's four cities, Sodom, Gomorrah, and some neighboring cities, and they're about to do what happened in Noach's time, which is the place gets
overturned.
The place gets overturned. We learn also in Jonah that overturned could also mean tshuva. There's an opportunity to do tshuva. But in this case, they don't do tshuva. But here comes the generations after Noah. This Abraham, this progenitor? No, is that the word?
The descendant.
Descendant of Noah. And this time, instead of being like, well, you know,
sounds a good plan, God.
The world's bad, and okay. If you have to overturn Sodom, they'll serve them right.
Chedi plu goy vecha.
Right. Exactly. But Abraham, who, again, I might get sued for this, I think has the kernel of the first Jewish liberal. I think that he's got...
No, absolutely. Ain't
yeah,
it's a fake.
Yeah,
because he's the universal heart of the Torah.
Right.
That's why a lot of Jews like Abraham more than they like Moses.
Right. But notice, by the way, in both the cases that we'll deal with, about Abraham's liberalism both get overturned, meaning to say he makes the case.
In this case, God listens. He says, thank you for your input.
But no. Okay? And what happened, and first thing before we get to that, is that there's a few narrative lines from God. God sticks in a few lines here, which are fabulously interesting,
yes,
in which God says, should I cover up? Shall I conceal from Abraham what I do? And Abraham is surely to become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by him. For I have loved him, for he will command his children and his household after him, that's us, that they keep the way of Hashem, doing charity and justice, in order that Hashem may then bring upon Abraham that which he had spoken of him. Holy moly. That was like a... I'm going to now... Basically, in other words, I got to talk to Abraham, because Abraham's really important to me. I can't keep these big things from him.
And this is another one of the places, by the way, where one has to train oneself to read with a close eye, because when it says, V'Hashem amah ha-mechaseni ma'avram, am I going to hide this from Abraham? Who is God speaking to? You know, as a reader, you have the sense that God's speaking to you.
Right.
Or you're being drawn in to the text in order to realize how important this moment is. And to me, a lot of its importance is in the fact that it says, Ki yadativ, right? Because I have known him. Mm-hmm. And we're offered here, like Rashi says, what does it mean to know, right? And this is a big challenge in life in general. It's not informational. Rashi says, right, Lashon Chiba, right? And he goes on a much longer. It's worth it to look at the Rashi on that. He says that knowing here is a language of a valuation, a preciousness, a love. That meaning I've attached myself to Abraham. And that's created a new reality in the world, says God. I can't just ignore that and go and right. do my thing. God is, in a certain sense, through those covenants, bound himself to Abraham. And it's the only thing that limits God's freedom in this story at this point. He says, I can't do this before I tell him, even though, as you pointed out, Abraham doesn't succeed in changing God's intention. Nevertheless, the very fact that God feels bound to inform him shows us that this is the first limitation we've seen on divine intention since the beginning.
And this section that we're coming up to, I think one of the most famous sections in the Torah, and also one that is, it raises your eyebrows, because there's a chutzpah. I remind people that our Muslim cousins believe in general that you cannot change God's mind. That's right. Just a general Islamic belief. You don't change God's mind. You're an ant. You're not.
Islam means submission.
Right. You have to submit to God's will. And here Abraham is going into a respectful chutzpahdik argument.
Struggle.
A struggle with God.
Yisrael. He's right. Struggling with God.
Right. And he's going to be. So let me just tell the narrative, which is he's going to argue with him for the non-destruction of Sodom, and he offers him and says, listen, if there's maybe there's 50 righteous people, and God says, basically, I won't do it if there's 50 righteous people. But another way to say it is there aren't 50 righteous people. And it gets down to 10.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it goes from 50, strangely, to 45, and then by tens.
Right.
But it gets down to 10. 10, you know, God says, I won't do it if there's 10 righteous people. And the end turns out they ain't no 10 righteous people in Sodom.
Yeah.
Which is, by the way, I was thinking about that. I was just thinking about that. Like, wow, that's a pretty
bad
that's
news.
A pretty Noah pre-Noah world there, that like there's like a town full of licentiousness and hate and violent crime, etc., and crazy laws. That's another thing that the rabbis write a lot about, which is these things were in law. They yes. were in. They were democratic. They were with justice. They were in the system. It wasn't that people were getting away with bad. Bad was institutionalized.
Well, we've spoken about it. This is, in my eyes, the origin in the rabbinic mind of that danger of transforming our shortcomings into ideologies. I mean, that's the difference. Is that if I see myself as failing periodically in what I do, then at least I'm being honest. If I take my failures and I elevate them into a standard of measure for other people, well, then I'll never be able to change. I mean, you have to be who you are, and you have to accept that on some level. On the other hand, you don't have to transform that in the right way into the right way to be.
Right. And after Abraham's long discourse with God, in which they come to a kind of understanding that I won't destroy the world if there's 10, it says that Abraham kind of went back to his place. He didn't become haughty that I just had a face-to-face with Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, God. And like, now he goes back and he's not like, I'm the second to the king, like a Haman type thing. He's the opposite. He goes back, shrinks back down to what he is, which is a human being. Anochi afar ve'efer. I am nothing but dust and dirt, and I go back down to my proper borders of what I am as a human being, a created person.
Nevertheless, to me, and I know we got a lot to cover, it's important to me to bring out that this story, when Avram says to God, "Shofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat," won't the judge of all the earth do justice? It's a deep question here of where does Avram get his sense of justice from that allows him to challenge God? And this is the root in the Torah of the idea that justice is something which exists within human consciousness that can be unearthed and not just instructed. Because if Avram got his notion of justice directly from God, then what's God telling him that he sees as unjust? I'm very wary of the notion that justice is always an external, or that everything which the Bible tells us is ipso facto just. Here, Avram is showing us, no, there is a requirement on the human being to decide what they believe is just, to challenge God at the same time what you're pointing out, and sometimes to be wrong. Yeah, and then go back to your place when God says, okay, I hear you, thanks for the effort.
The fact is that God included this story in the Bible.
Right.
Meaning to say this is a seen as a...
And Avram was correct that it would be unjust. Right. He was just wrong about what was happening in stone.
Right, right. Okay, so then we have one of the more graphic of stories in the Bible, and I wanted to say this before, which is I used to teach third grade and fifth grade at Temple Emmanuel, the Reformed flagship temple in Manhattan.
How'd they let you in there?
It's a great story, and I taught there for years. Uh-huh. I taught there for years and years. Not only that, when I left, my sister got my position.
Okay, business.
I taught it for years. Very hard. It was not an easy, but very eye-opening experience. And it was every Sunday morning. So it was, you know, so I had to get up Sunday morning. You know, like a college student that does not get up Sunday morning. I had to get up early, be dressed, and go down to the east side and teach the people and teach
the children.
At least half of them were Jewish. And one of the things that I came up with, now teaching third grade Reform Temple of very wealthy kids, not an easy task. Do they really want to be there?
No.
No, they don't want to be there on a Sunday morning. And it's just, it really is like pulling teeth. So you had to make it fun. You really had to make it fun. And what I learned was, this, I came up with this myself, is don't spare them this stuff. In fact, tell them the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Tell them that. I remember telling that story and I remember their eyes. Because I thought to myself, if I square out the Torah, they'll get their kicks from TV.
Oh, for sure.
But if I make it that the Torah is exciting and has all of the carnal issues, okay, that they'll be like, oh, the Torah is
That's the source.
That's a cool thing. And I should relate to that as a cool thing.
By the way,
an interesting thing.
By the way, the instruction I've gotten from my teachers when it comes to sex ed is learn the Tanakh. And when the questions come up, deal with them as they come up.
Mm.
It's right there.
Great. That's great. That's an interesting thing. Is that for all ages or what? Or when the kids ask you questions?
Yeah, meaning let their questions guide the process, but where do the questions most naturally come from, like you're pointing out, from the text?
Wow. Okay, I have an 11-year-old, a 7-year-old. They are quite textually concerned.
Equipped.
Yeah, they're very like they're asking me questions. So okay, we'll we'll probe it. Anyway, let's keep going. Basically, comes the two angels into town, into Sodom.
Just picture walking
right?
down.
They're just walking down.
With the six shooters on the hip. That's
right.
What you made it sound like.
Well, on the one hand, yes, but on the other hand, they look like little innocent, like
victims.
Yeah,
they just kind of sneak into town.
Right. They're very much, you know, agents. They're very much agents in there, and they're kind of scoping out the scene, and you get the sense maybe that even God is using them as the kaviyachol, seemingly, like the eyes, checking out what's really going on. They get to Lot. Lot says to them, come into my house. They say, no, we'll sleep in the streets. He's thinking, don't sleep in the streets. Bad idea, because you'll get messed up out here. And he's got some Abrahamic, it seems, that we sense that he's got some Abrahamic, still some remnants of good.
Some training.
And it says, the Torah says that he bugged them. He begged them to come into his house. The Medra says that Lot's wife, Irit, is not, it's not mentioned in the Bible, but that's the Medra tells us is that she was on the bad side of things, and she kind of gave away that there's guests, which was a big no-no in the town. They sit down to eat. Soon enough, knock, 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 and the whole town has gathered from young to old.
Right.
And they say, bring out your guests so that we may know them.
Yeah, it's an intense scene.
It's interesting that the word know is said because there's a certain kind of tongue-in-cheek because know has heretofore meant something kind of good and deeper and a relationship type thing. But what we're talking about here is sodomy.
It's
comes
rape.
From the word Sodom.
Yes.
Right. And rape and a very violent crime coupled with violent sexuality, you know, really nothing. It's nothing of the knowing that we've known.
No.
It's a bad kind of knowing. Okay. And so Lot comes out. Lot comes out and he says, my brothers, don't do this bad thing. And then he takes out, like, you know, here's a picture of my two daughters. Here's the weirdest line in the whole Bible.
It's one of the hardest things.
Do what you want to them.
He only offers one, I think.
Huh? But. Okay. He offers his daughter or daughters. Let's see it. No. Hinen na li shtei banot.
Oh, it's shtei banot.
Two daughters. Asher lo yadu.
Where that part of the story doesn't end well either.
Right. Okay. But don't hurt these people that have come to be sheltered under my roof. And they said to him, step aside, boy. What, are you going to judge us? This is an interesting. Are you going to judge us? And this harkens back to the are you a judge? Is that who you are?
This is all echoing straight back to God's conversation with Abraham. God knew Abraham. God chose Abraham because he knew righteousness and justice. And so there, the part of the problem here also is almost a perusha, a commentary on Avram's life, is that, listen, you might be Avram, but you can't be Avram in the middle of Sodom.
You can't be Avram in Sodom.
No, it doesn't work.
Right.
Right. Meaning part of what we see in the world is God encourages the good within people, but also has to destroy the bad. It's not enough just to have Avram in the world. Sodom also has to be destroyed.
Mm.
Right, and Lot's mistake, if we want to judge Lot kindly, is he thought he could be Avraham in Sodom. And that's what you see. He knew what was right. going on. He knew the danger. Nevertheless, he was welcoming guests, etc. He thought, okay, you know, they're not such good people, but I'll do what's... And he's about to learn that it doesn't work. They don't go together.
So, this another beautiful biblical image. A hand comes out of the door and pulls Lot in.
Right.
Okay.
As if he right through the door.
It's a little harkening back to the ark.
Ah.
Okay. It's just like he closes the door for them. You know,
yeah, and the chaos on the outside.
He kind of like pulls them in. He saves them. The angels save Lot, and they hit the all these townsmen.
The mob
with blinders. They're like,
I can't see where to go.
I can't
the door.
See. And then there's this greatest line in which. They were unable to, or they continued, they tried vainly to find the entrance.
Uh-huh.
They continuously tried to
get in
there. And obviously there's also like a sexual connotation here. And it's like they tried, but they couldn't, you know, do their deed. So the angels say, who else you have here? And he says, I've got son-in-laws. So they say, look, we come here to destroy the town. Talk to your son-in-laws.
Gather your folk and
gather
get out.
Your folk and gather again. The son-in-law's two by two. I'm mm-hmm. offering you a two by two option here.
Right.
Okay. So it would be remember like
the ark.
Like the ark, but no, the son-in-laws laugh at him. Here's that laughing word again. They laugh at him like, ha ha ha, you're a fool. Okay. He was like a fool in their eyes, and the problem is that Lot is. This is a great word. I'm not a cantillator, but it's like, I'll do it in the end, right? I'll do it in English. Still he lingered, right?
Yeah. It's one of those great lines.
Vitmahmeh, and there's that, I don't remember the
name of that.
The squiggly trope. Squiggly cantillation that means like I can hear all my the listeners of the show, like my friend Aaron, who's a great Balkora. And he's going to be like, he shites this. Anyway, the point is that there's a famous kind of the cantillation is a delay, and so the word itself is also, and he delays or he lingers. Angels grab him. Because God is, it says, because God is merciful upon him. They take him outside of the city. Don't look behind you. Don't look behind you. And I saw that don't look behind you because you don't have the right to judge them. Don't look behind there and get any pleasure that they're being judged and you've been saved. Because you're really, as you just talked about, Rabbi Mike, you're also part of the sin.
Yes.
And so I'm being kind to you, but you don't have the right to look back and be like, serves you right. I always knew you guys were going to get in trouble. You don't have that leisure, that pleasure.
I hear that. I think there's also an element there that we all face in the challenge when we've made the right decision, or in this case, when someone has forced us to make the right decision, that one of the most corrosive psychological postures is nostalgia and regret. You know, the Rambam actually says that a person who does a mitzvah and then comes to regret what they've done is as if they hadn't done it. Mm-hmm. Right? So here it's like, don't look back. Don't spend the rest of your life saying, oh, you know, it was good to be saved, but man, life in stone was good.
Right.
You know, because what you're doing is basically poisoning everything going forward.
Right.
Like you need to be grateful that you were saved, and you need to build your life looking forward on the recognition of where you came from was destroyed because it was evil.
You know, I want to just for 1 second talk about what you just said in terms of Aliyah, but I want to make a distinction, which is there are some people who make Aliyah and look back at America, Canada, Australia, England, and they go, I'm never looking back. That place was a Sodom-type place, and I'm going to the Holy Land, and this is where God is, and that other place was disgusting. There, I don't agree with that. I think that when it comes to these countries, there was a lot of good, and you came by choice. And in many ways, if you could bring with you some of the intellectual and physical wealth of those places and bring them to our land, it will raise up that offering that you've brought from those countries, from those lands.
I agree 100%. I actually, it wasn't a conscious decision at the time, but I came to realize that the 2 years I spent working with at-risk youth in a wilderness therapy program before I made it back here, for me was Hakarat HaTov. It was my opportunity to give back to a country which had brought in my grandparents as immigrants or survivors and had nurtured me in the most sort of wealthy, powerful, welcoming society humanity has ever known. So I agree 100%.
Yeah, I think it's not the same. It's not the same. If, on the other hand, for example, you ran away from a country that kicked you out in a horrible fashion,
that's
different. Yeah, so you know exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I come from the Russian background, and what's funny about Russian Jews is that they love Russian culture, but when they get too excited, I always remind them, I'm like, but it is a crappy country, right? It's like yes, there are many great cultural things that we all love, and there's a certain even shtickle haughtiness that sometimes I find amongst the Russian Jews. And I remind them, just to bring it down, sometimes I go, but it is a cruddy country, right? I mean, you don't want to live there. Nobody wants to live there. They're like, yeah. So that's sometimes you got to remind them. Any case, okay, so the next scene that we have to get to is, remember, Lot offers his daughters to the rape mob. Rape gang, right? I think that's the proper nomenclature for that. But anyway, so that was a weird thing to say. Next scene, when they run away, they get to a cave, and the
wife's gone because
she looked back. She was like, I just got to shop at Target one more time. Take me to the mall, and she becomes a pillar of salt.
Don't do it, people. Don't look back.
Anyway, she looked back, and the sages kind of paint her as really a sodomite in terms of her culture. Two daughters, they run away. They get to a cave, basically look out into apocalyptic a desert of destruction,
rain down fire and brimstone,
right.
Smoking ruins,
right? And they're thinking to themselves, I think they think Noah.
Yeah.
They think to themselves, this is Noah's Ark.
World is over.
And the world's gone nuclear, you know, it's gone down. And so now and here's a beautiful thought that they have, which is, let's promulgate humanity once again.
Species going.
Right. I mean, first thing, what's that thought? That's an interesting question to me. Like, I started thinking, like, why did they have that thought?
Because I think it's the most deep-rooted drive within any creature, but certainly within humanity. Like, we must continue.
Right. So the husbands are sodomites. They're dead. The wife is dead. It's Lot and his daughters in a cave and a bottle of wine.
Several.
Right. The bottle of wine at the edge of the cave. Hey, what's this?
Rashi even says, but he's the man lamb. And Rashi, like, this is one of those moments where Rashi's like, okay, problem in the narrative. We're just going to say, and it happened to be there was a lot of wine in this cave in order to make the next scene happen.
It's the Noah thing. See again. At the end of the story, there's a bottle of wine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's interesting.
It's a piece of work to make it happen. They just found it there.
Okay, they found it there. Maybe it was Noah's wine. Who knows? Maybe Noah left this. Noah was
classic,
here. They found
classic
it in the back
vintage.
Of the cave. It's an awesome, awesome thing. See, for some piece of people, that would bother them. For me, it doesn't bother me. I love it. The question is, where did the wine come from?
For sure.
And that's the fun part of it. You're like, because the text knows that it left you a bottle of wine out of nowhere. It's like Legend of Zelda here. It's like out of nowhere. There's like a thing to pick up. Anyway, bottle of wine is key for the next scene because maybe for Lot it would be somewhat unpleasant to continue to have intercourse with his daughters. Bottle of wine smooths that over. And you know
Well, I mean, let's be straight about it. The two girls conspire between them, led by the elder, to get him so drunk he won't know what's happening.
Right. And Rashi says he was asleep, meaning to say he was asleep. But
to
anyway,
this day, there is a category in Jewish law of halacha of shikro shalot, right? When you reach a state of what we would call blackout drunkenness, where you actually have no recollection of what you've done, that has halachic ramifications.
Right. Right.
And they call it shikro shalot.
That's right. Okay. And I just had some chastara that I just dealt with, so I know that such a thing exists. In any case,
be careful, Musa,
Baruch Hashem. Any case, so Lot's daughters cohabit with him, each in their turn. They become pregnant, and they give birth to two enemy nations for the Jewish people, the Moabites and the Ammonites. Ammonites basically have no recourse, but the Moabites, it turns out, later down the line, that the seed of Mashiach is going to come through this line. Really? Does it really need to come through this line? Now, the mystical doctrine tells us that it needs to go through this line because the seed of Messiah needs to be in the darkest places, hidden away from the clutches of the real dark forces.
Of the other side.
Right. It's like you'll never search it here.
That's right. I mean,
I even get afraid to talk about this. I get a little nervous to talk about it.
It's revealing some rather deep secrets. But one thing I would just point out is that it's a consistent element of the whole story of Mashiach. From this moment to the coming, you know, in a few weeks, interaction between Yehuda and Tamar, right, where he thinks he's sleeping with a prostitute and ends up being his daughter-in-law. You know,
best story in the Bible.
Right, to David and Bathsheba, which we can say is just a complex relationship. You know, there seems to be, and in particular, by the way, in particular, this tension between sexual desire and propagation of the species, and doing what's right.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In each of those cases that you can locate sort of all those elements, and that has so much to do with this sort of messianic vision, that messianic vision is not something that comes from outside. It's not some abstract, and this is where we very much differ with our Christian brothers and sisters. This is not something that has to come from outside because the human condition is not fit for such perfection, and it's only through grace that salvation is given to us, right? The Torah's perspective on messianism is that we have to fix the deepest, darkest, most earthy places within humanity, and it's through the energy of fixing those places specifically that salvation comes. Because the truth of the matter is, the sort of the perfect, holy, soulful aspects of us are nothing new to God. That's not what we offer to God. What we offer to God is specifically these deep, dark places, because that's the human condition, and it's by fixing the human condition that the messianic arises.
Hmm. Yes. There's a lot there. And you and I focused on two different things. You focused on the good, and I'm focusing on the power also of the bad, which is also interesting to me, which is like, keep this, pass this thing on.
And keep it hidden.
Keep it hidden, like Moses being hidden from the Egyptian killers. Okay. And also, by the way, very, very clear metaphors, the cave, the house. It's like a very laden type of, you know, the cave is a womb where these two nations are going to be born. Okay. And the Lot story ends there.
That's good.
For
I'm
now.
Sweating.
Huh?
I said, that's good. I'm sweating.
Yeah, that's right. It's racy. It's racy. But it doesn't stop there in terms of being racy. Next one is also another racy story. Here comes Abraham, and he's hanging out in basically the Gaza Strip, mm-hmm. in Grar. Okay, in Grar, which is basically west of Beersheba.
Nachal Bessul.
Right? And his wife gets kind of grabbed after Avimelech, who's the king of the Philistines down there, basically is told that she's the sister. And he takes her. According to the rabbis, he already was really about to consummate the act with her, but basically God brings a dream at night, and he says, "You're gonna die, boy.
Dead man.
You're gonna die. Why? Because you took a wife of somebody else." And he stays away with from her, and he
says, whoa. He said she was his sister.
And this is
that's exactly what he says.
Right. And then he's got another line. You're gonna kill a righteous Gentile, right? A goy gam tzaddik torah, give a Gentile who's also a righteous person, are you gonna kill? Well, again,
it's going straight back to Abraham's discussion.
Right.
It's like, really? This is how you roll, God? You just wipe people out regardless of whether they've done anything wrong or not?
Oh, my gosh.
And by the way, it's important to know that much of this parsha is a subtle but profound criticism on the flood. Just wipe everybody out?
Right.
Just wipe out. That's how you work?
Right.
And that's what Avram says. You're going to wipe everybody? That's how you work? Here's
how
you
Melech. Oh, my gosh. It's just so awesome. It's just such great stuff that the Torah would have a critique on God. I don't know. It's just so beautiful and so challenging. In any case, so check this out. Here we learn another few things through crisis. And I have a theory that in the Torah we learn many things about God through crisis. Okay, many places God will learn about him. But in any case, here we're going to learn about Abraham. Says to him, God in a dream. He says, "I know that you didn't mean to do this bad thing, and therefore I have spared you from sinning to me by not letting you touch her. And now you better return the woman to this man, for he is a prophet." This is the first time we meet this word. For he is a prophet, whatever that means. Ki navihu, he's a prophet. Vitpalel badcha v'chayeh, and he's going to pray for you.
Also, the first time you meet that word,
right? And he's going to pray for you, and you're going to like, wait a minute. We're already having the conversation. You already know that I didn't mean to do it, anything bad.
You're God,
right? Why does this other person need to pray for me so that I can get healed? And God's like, no, he's a prophet. You need to hear his prayer. Back to the tongues. The tongue is important. The words are important. We need to hear Abraham's prayer.
Well, this is entirely the role of both prophecy and prayer, which is God's desire that humanity be the vehicle for realizing divine will in the world. Right? It's obvious, but it's worth stating that whatever God wants, God has. So it's like a question that why don't we live in a perfect world? And Abraham is forging this path in the world where basically when he stands up to God and says, "What? Shofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat? You can't do that, God." What he's saying to God is, I know you better than that, God. You have a deeper will. You have a deeper will. So why is the world not expressing God's deeper will? Because God wants us to express God's deeper will in the world. That's right. What prayer is. That's what the prophet is. God could do it without us.
Right.
That's not what God wants. Right. God created a world which is not fully expressive and gave humanity the capacity to see God's will, which is not yet. And that's what the prophet is doing. And that's what we do when we pray. Like we say, Rofech, you know, Chole Amo Yisrael. We're praying that God, you're the one that heals all the sick. Really, if God's the one that heals all the sick, how come I'm praying for my sick friend?
Right.
The answer is because God wants me to want that.
Mm-hmm.
Wants me to embody that will in the world. That's mm-hmm. what it is to be a prophet and one who prays. And that's why they appear for the first time in the biblical narrative together in the same line, embodied in Abraham.
And it's a teaching for us that prayer is an important value. It's an important thing. And it is a vehicle for healing. and a vehicle for blessing. Like, you actually have to say it, and how did you say it? Discover it or reveal it?
I want to reiterate, because this is a very different way of praying than most people are aware. And people can write to me. I'm happy to send you material on it. It's something I've been working on for a long time. That you're not just asking God for something. What you're doing is you're trying to embody God's will in the world. We don't end in the Amida and the 18 blessings. We don't say, Baruch Atah Hashem, please heal my friend. We say, Baruch Atah Hashem, you are the one who heals.
Right.
And by holding the truth of that in the face of the fact that I have someone who's sick, is you're giving space for God as healing to be in the world. And that's why Avraham is able to give that space. By the way, what happens? Avraham, everybody gives birth in Avraham's, in Avimelech's house, right? That's the result.
So basically, what you didn't know is that in Avimelech's household, everybody was stopped up
in every way.
Which way. In every which way. You know, they could barely blow their nose, let alone go to the bathroom or have
give
children.
Birth.
Yeah, things were and think about that as Abraham being a channel and what's the word I'm looking for? I have a different word than channel. Not a portal. A conduit. Conduit, that's the word I'm looking at. He's a conduit. And if you're messing up the conduit, there's no blessing coming down to the world.
That's right.
And interestingly, it goes another way, which is when he gets his wife back, when he prays for the health of these others, suddenly the conduit comes towards him also. And that is when Sarah becomes pregnant, her skin becomes young again, and she indeed gives birth to Yitzchak. And our rabbis teach us that when you want to pray for something, pray for somebody else. Basically what I do, and I'm sure you do the same, but it's basically whenever I want something, I think to myself, who do I know that is
really
in similar straits or something like that? And I'm like, who else has a wart on their toe, okay, that needs praying for?
Because it saves our prayer from being an act of gimme, gimme, gimme.
Right.
And transforms it into a desire that God's will be more manifest in the world.
Yafe. Okay. And finally, there's a few more parts in the discussion between Avimelech and Avraham. But I want to get to just the end there, which is, says Avimelech, here's my land before you. Settle whatever you think is good. I've given you money in order to, I've given Sarah money in order to kind of forget the incident.
Let's just smooth it over.
But wait, there was one thing I missed here. And that is that at the end, we're going to also through this whole process of the relationship between Avimelech and Abraham, which, by the way, a peace deal is cut, and some sages give a hard time to Abraham for cutting that peace deal with Avimelech and his land, and kind of recognizing that it's his land. But in any case, one of the things that definitely comes out of it is that Avraham sets out seven sheep on their own, kind of on a hill. Can you imagine, like, seven sheep grazing by themselves? Avimelech says, "What are these seven sheep that you've put by themselves?" Abraham says, "These seven sheep you'll take for me, that'll be a witness here that I've dug this well." And therefore the place was called the Well of Seven, for they had sworn there, because the word Lishaba and Sheva are the same root. And so seven sheep, the oath was taking place there, and Be'er Sheva is born. Okay? And then Abraham is going to also plant a tree in Be'er Sheva, and he's going to call the name of God, and there he's going to actually make really his first big school of monotheism. And I think that's just important, and we're going to meet Be'er Sheva again. Be'er Sheva, one of the holy cities of the land of Israel, not often talked about, but really Abraham's first place of great teaching to the nations of the world. And if you looked at it today, it's coming back to being an important city,
because
the IDF has moved all of its major bases to that region. In the ancient times, Be'er Sheva, very important, right smack on the trade routes, on the spice route, an incredibly important intersection between
the
continents.
And the port in Gaza.
That's right. So a very important place, and it's a flat, deserty land, not exactly the most hospitable place.
I was there for a semester in college.
Right. That's right. And that's where you met Shmuel Goldman.
That's a good friend.
That's right. Yeah. And
the town
and
of seven sworn sheep.
That's right. Something very cool about Be'er Sheva, and I think that I wish that it had more of a place to visit. They have developed a very interesting site there called Abraham's Well, and I enjoyed that site very much. Still, though, I think it's a holy city and somehow unexploited as also a holy city. Okay, two more things we got to get to here. The other moment of Abrahamic liberalism. Can I call it the show Abrahamic liberalism? Can I call it that?
Whatever makes you happy.
Do you think that's going to make other people happy?
It depends on which people.
Okay, so first thing is that, ta-da! Hey, everybody, happy birthday! Mazel tov, Yitzchak is born!
Woohoo!
And look, and Yitzchak, everybody's like, you know what? There's no way. There's just no way. Okay, this is totally fake.
They found some kid.
It's a fake baby.
Okay. Well, they found some kid. Yeah. Sarah gave birth.
I'm going to call the show Sarah Fake Pregnancy, okay? Fake baby.
Yitzchak
all right?
Fake news.
It's birth of Yitzchak fake news, okay? That's good. I like that.
You should get royalties on these titles.
I know. They don't pay me enough. Anyway, so...
that was a joke, if you're listening.
Yes. So back to the thing. So Sarah, now everybody, why are we saying this? We're laughing. We didn't say the joke yet, which is people don't believe it's from Sarah. They believe that
a Sufi minashuk.
Right.
They found an abandoned child.
Baby. Right.
Yeah.
Dingo stole my baby. That's for the Australians. Okay. They found some dingo baby. That's what they said. So God made two miracles happen. One miracle is that Yitzchak looked just like Abba. He looked like Abba. And you've seen this. You've seen a person walking down the street. You've also seen...
I've got a son who looks just like me.
That's right. There you go. And you've also seen people with their dogs, and their dog looks exactly like that.
That's a little bit more awkward, but it's true.
That's something different.
It is true.
Okay, that was in parentheses. End parentheses. Isaac looks just like Abraham. That's one. That's from the Abraham line. And from the Sarah line, here's the deal. People are like, no, she didn't. Maybe this was...
Yeah, at the birth celebration, everybody brings their kids.
Everybody brings their kids.
Like in our celebrations, it's a mess.
Right, and they forgot to bring their wet
nurses.
Right. And all the kids, like 100 royalty kids, start going, wah, wah,
same time.
Wah. I want lunch. And then Sarah, our mother Sarah, nurses them all.
Straight down the line.
She shoots them, like she feeds them all and they all got knocked out.
Out okay. Cold.
And basically the whole world's like, oh, okay, I guess she did give birth. Because she's able to nurse these 100 kids, great. Okay, so and with Isaac, you will. This is your continuation, and he is also we see that he's growing up very quickly. Indeed, he becomes what's it called? He gamel. What's the word when you
weaned?
Stop? Weaned. Thank you very much. Okay, so that's all good news
for most people.
For most people, but. Except for Hagar.
The other woman.
The other woman. Oh,
and
no.
And more importantly, the other son.
The other son. That's the big one.
That's the kicker.
And Sarah says to Abraham, I'm sorry. This just can't work. You got to kick your concubine / wife and your son.
Firstborn.
Your firstborn Ishmael. They can't grow up together. Their two national identities cannot coexist.
Maybe we cannot have them in the same town.
It doesn't work. It doesn't work. And Abraham says it's very bad in his eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, and I love how laconic the Torah here is. Like, can you please feel the pain of Abraham?
And it's important to do that. It is very bad in his eyes. Doesn't make it untrue.
No.
But it's just very bad.
Very bad. Very painful.
Yeah.
I mean, can you just put yourself in the desert for a second and you're like, okay, like my this person that I've had a child with, this child that I've raised now for many years, leave this camp? Like, what's the moment after?
Right.
Like, where they're gone? It's very, very painful.
Yeah.
It's very painful. And I think that some might think that a person like me may not have a heart for Ishmael and for Abraham's relationship to Ishmael. That's wrong. That's not correct. I do have a heart for that. And I just want to say, like, no, and also, by the way, sometimes people say to me, it's when Brit Bein HaBetarim and the covenant between the parts, that Abraham gets told that his seed will inherit from the Euphrates to the Nile, like that's also, it could very well be that means also Ishmael's children, because that's the seed of Abraham.
Sure.
Any case, so he has to, so then it looks very bad in his eyes, and this is a very important thing that happens, is that Sarah says to Abraham, Geresh et ha'amazot. Wow. She said to Abraham, drive away the slave woman and her son, for the son of that slave woman shall not inherit with my son, with Isaac. And here they added an exclamation point.
Right.
Bang. The matter greatly distressed Abraham regarding his son. So God said to Abraham, be not distressed over the youth or your slave woman. Whatever Sarah tells you, heed her voice, since through Isaac will offspring be considered yours. But don't worry, the son of the slave woman as well will I make into a nation, for he is your offspring. So meaning to say there's two things going on here. One is that I will allay your pain. It's going to be okay. But there's another thing here, which is a slight critique of Abraham. You didn't see. Sarah saw with her fleshly eyes. You didn't see with your fleshly eyes. I say this to people that sometimes I'll say to people, well, we have to separate and this and that maybe. And then people will be like, you need a prophet to tell you that kind of thing. You don't know if the Palestinians today are the Philistines of the past or this and that. And they give you a whole theological thing. And I go, look at the story of Abraham and Sarah. In this case, where God says to Abraham, listen, he doesn't say, yes, drive away Ishmael. He's like, Sarah was right. She saw with
the mother's eyes,
with the mother's eyes, and with rationality, and with her prophetic abilities. In any case, that he has to be driven away. Ishmael is driven away. There's a very poignant moment where Hagar and Ishmael run out of water. So Abraham's son is about to die of thirst, and she does something that is a little bit strange to Jewish people. This a little bit shows you the difference between the Ishmaelite line and the Jewish line, I think, in that she kind of sends she puts him under some kind of bush or some kind of under tree, and she walks away at a certain distance as to not hear her son cry and die. I think that there's something there that tells you these are a different type of people than Jewish people, I think. You can disagree with me. But in any case, she cries out. God opens her eyes. She sees a spring of water. She fills up the, interestingly enough, it says she fills up the water jug or the, what do you call it? The water, skin, the water skin. And she gives water to the boy. And the boy, God is with the boy. He grows up and he becomes an archer. Okay. And then he marries an Egyptian woman. So the whole line of Ishmael is saved, but it's separated out. Mm-hmm. From Isaac. Is that politically incorrect?
I mean, it's applying a frame of judgment to this that I don't think is relevant. Meaning, I think part of the if you want to take moral lessons from the Torah, one of the things that you have to do is look at it as just a reality.
But if you read this story to your students here at our beloved Pardes Institute.
So they find it very challenging because their notion of sort of a just, right world is where everybody gets to be together, right? And
that's a good point. That's a good point. Everybody gets to be together. It's interesting.
Yeah. And this is one of the great challenges, which is that we're Am Levadad Yishkon.
Mm-hmm.
We're a nation that's meant to dwell apart.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever that means for people that were placed at the crossroads of the ancient world.
Right.
But there is something intrinsic in Am Yisrael is that we are meant to be other.
Mm-hmm.
Unless that's in service of a mission that people can sign on to and feel motivated by, it's usually experienced in today's world as exclusionary or supremacist or hate-ridden, you know, to the point where the idea of a Jew marrying another Jew, because that's what a Jew does, is perceived by many people as racist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, you want to marry a Jew because you don't like Goyim? Well,
I
want to marry a Jew because I want to marry a Jew because I want to be Jewish and I want my children to be Jewish.
Can I ask you? I'm gonna say a phrase and I need your scoring on it or rating on it. Okay,
uh-huh.
or tell me if it's good or bad. Really, I'm
ready.
I'm a gashesh here. I'm just filling it out. Sometimes I say to people, there's a difference between racist and racial. Meaning to say, racist is I'm saying that something else is lower, debased. I look down upon it. But racial, yeah. I'm not saying it's race. I'm not saying that. It's a dominance, but I do want to stay racial. Yes, I want to stay within my peoplehood. I want to stay this and that.
Yeah.
I believe in national. But that's
You from even stepping into that pie of the language of race, since Am Yisrael, it's not really relevant.
Well, okay, but race. Oh, okay, ethnicity. You know what I mean?
Wait, but that's my point. So you asked me to rate it. I would say you're making a mistake even stepping into that discourse by using the word. I understand the distinction you're making
because there's nationalism. See, I think that nationalism still has a value, and I understand that as a simple logic. The simple logic to nationalism. And I want to say nationalism is not racism. Those are not. It's not a fair equation. Is that an equation that's being made out there, that nationalism
often,
is racism?
Often, because you have to remember, or you should know if you're unaware, that the definition of racism has morphed in the last 10, maybe 15 years. The discourse in America, at least, is that around the questions of, like, you know, if a black police officer accosts, you know, a white driver because they're white, you know, as opposed to the normal situation of Tapping America, the whole problem of, you know, driving while black, that white police officers are accosting and shooting young black men in America. So that's not racist if a black man does it. How could that be true if it's about race? And the answer is because the modern definition of racism is it's power plus prejudice. There's an assumption that it's really a discourse of power. And so this is one of the reasons that the Jews don't fit well into it, because the Jews are perceived as having power. So therefore, the Jews can never be the subject of racism because we have power. We're not disempowered. It has a lot to do with the role that the Jew plays in this whole intersectionality movement of the far left, and why we don't seem to get to play when all the other oppressed peoples of the world come together.
Right.
So I would just discourage you from even giving into that language.
Right.
The language of peoplehood, the language of nation, you know, those are, I think, are more accurate.
Right, more accurate. Definitely more accurate. Okay. I wanted to use the alliteration, but I see now. Good. I'm glad that we discussed that. Okay, we got to finish off, but at the same time, we're about to hit the
big story.
We got the big bump here, and that is, let's just set it up very quickly. Throughout this Torah portion, we've really dealt with moral questions. We've dealt with Abraham pushing back on the destruction of Sodom. We've dealt with the Lot trying to save the angels and the destruction of Sodom. We've dealt with Avimelech and him pushing back on God to destroy a righteous Gentile seemingly. And we've also dealt with kicking Ishmael out, but for the sake of both Isaac, and the promise that Ishmael will continue to live. And without that amelioration, there's really no way that Abraham would have kind of agreed to that. And then, okay, so we've done all that. Isaac is born. Continuation is going to happen. It's going to be fulfilled. It's guaranteed. That's what the word I'm looking for. Isaac is this next generation. He's going to inherit. He's going to be the seed of Abraham. Abraham is this man who has been fighting all this time against the idolatry of the land, against child sacrifice and these kind of things. Suddenly, bang, okay? God is going to call on to Abraham, and he's going to test him, and he's going to say to him, I want you to take your son, your only son, your real son, your continuation, Isaac, the one you've loved, and I want you to take him and sacrifice him up. And he's going to take the famous walk of pain, okay? Walk of 3 days of contemplation, the famous Kierkegaardian, 3 days of think it through.
Of fear and trembling.
Fear and trembling and consternation about what's happening. I found a great medrash that I like so much, which is basically that three different players, the Satan dressed up as three different players, Satan, in order to stop Abraham. One was an old man, a wise old man. You know, think about the wisdom of it. And he turns to Abraham in wisdom. Is this wise? God gave you this child. Does it make sense? You know, like in smart contemplation. Mm-hmm. And then he comes into the face of a young boy, fresh face, right? And his point is,
how could you do it?
No, this is to Isaac. He goes to Isaac. He's like, your dad got heat stroke, bro. You know what I mean? You don't, this is not the right way to do. Your dad's a good man. You're the continuation. You got to live. And then finally, when that's blocked, both of those are beaten, a plain old river, river that blocks your
barrier,
right? A barrier that blocks you to come to both the Mount Moriah. Stops you from coming to the Mount Moriah, okay? And I could say a lot more about those three forces out there. But in any case, blocks you from coming to Mount Moriah. And then we have the binding. The binding is Isaac saying, you know, where are we going?
Where is this going, Dad?
Where is this going? And he says, Abraham says, God will show us the...
God sees...
Well, God will seek out for himself the lamb for the offering, my son.
There's a very big difference between God will show us and God sees, or will seek out.
Right.
Because the theme of seeing started already back. I mean, by the way, it's what's the name of the parsha?
Vayera.
Right. That God appears.
Right.
But this theme of seeing is a consistent theme through the entire parsha. What happens, as you already quoted, that Hagar is there in the desert with her dying son. She doesn't know what to do, and it says God opened up her eyes,
right,
showed her that there's a well right there. I'm not going to drag you back through it, but there are, consistently through the parsha, is this notion that we actually live in a world which we don't see, right? And that the act of seeing is deeply bound up with the act of Yira. Because if you look, Yira is standing in awe and fear of God.
It's just parenthetically, I want to tell you that I met a young man over in Alon Moreh. Young guy. I saw that he was smart. I saw that he's in rabbinics and he's going in that direction. And he said to me, well, I'm considering going back to America because I think there's more options for me there. I said to him, let me give you a piece of advice for my life. You don't see the options.
Yes.
You got to pray for those options.
Yes.
And you've got to kind of follow God. And he's bringing us back to this land. Reconsider, because you don't know what options could be open for you here.
And this is precisely my point. That if you look at the way the word Yireh, to see, and Yirah, to stand in awe of God, are written, they're the same, right? Because what we see depends on the context within which we live. And that's what it means to stand in awe of God. If you really stand in awe of God, then God is the context for your life, in which case your eyes are open to things that other people won't see. And so this process of the binding is the culmination of Yitzchak's existence. Remember, why is his name Yitzchak? I made an argument because you've put two things together that don't work, and then you laugh. Well, here's Avram. God says, by the way, here's your future, the baby that you had at 99, and now sacrifice it. Those two things don't work, right? So in order to play that out in Avram's life, and for his eyes to truly be opened to God in the world, he has to go all the way with that, and it has to be by choice. It's important that people know that God does not command Abraham to sacrifice Yitzchak. He asks him to do it.
Right.
And so this is an act of free will.
I think that it's very important to mention the exilarch, Rabbi Dr. Lord Jonathan Sacks here, who said an amazing thing. I think he was arguing with a famous atheist. And the atheist brings...
Probably Richard Dawkins, huh?
Yeah, one of these guys. The other guy, I think. Sam Glazer, whatever. I don't remember the name. No, that's a rabbi. Oh, whatever it is. The other guy. He shan't be named here. In any case, so he... They're arguing...
Baltimore.
And Rabbi John... And the atheist says... He says, look at this. This is sick stuff. Abraham wants to sacrifice his son. And Rabbi Jonathan Sacks says, no, you totally missed the point, says Sacks. Rabbi Sacks says, this is a story about how God says, he said, in the ancient world, every God wanted you to sacrifice your son. This is God bringing Abraham to the apex of the act and being like, I don't want this. This is not what I want in this world, which I thought was a very elegant and interesting answer.
Well, it's very important because, you know, at the end, when Abraham gets his blessings, it says, Ekev asher shemata b'koli.
Right.
Right? And all the nations of the world will be blessed through you because you listen to my voice. And the question is, which one? The voice that told him to take Yitzchak and sacrifice him, or the voice that stopped him and said, no, that's not what I want? And I would argue it's because he was able to hear them both.
Right.
And furthermore, that he was able to hear Yitzchak's voice in all of that. Because he says, hineni, here I am, three times in this parsha. We don't really have the time to go through it all. I think we've done it in past years. But to me, the importance, the fact that he hears all three voices, he's able to hear them all, and that opens up a world of context where he's able to see options that no human being had yet seen, which is why, as you pointed out, it all culminates in him renaming Har Moriah to the mountain of Hashem Yireh. God sees, B'makom Asher Yireh, and that's where we will see God.
Right. And there's a famous mitzvah, which I like very much, which is to see and to be seen. When you show up in the festivals, you got to see God, but also be seen by him, but also argue by society. People have got to see you, got to inspire other people as well.
Listen, and the Temple Mount really embodies this power to this very day, perhaps now more than ever, which is, on one hand, it's this absurd notion, like what you're getting hung up on, you know, like a few hundred square meters of geography. We're talking about the universal God. Like that just sounds downright idolatrous. On the other hand, it's like, oh yeah, but the whole story revolves around that one point.
Mm.
So like, how do you hold that?
Speaking of that, I just want to do a plug. I want to do a few quick plugs here before we finish off. First thing is that my mom was on the Temple Mount today, has sent me a great picture. And why I say this is because my mom was interviewed on the Eve Harrow show. And I highly recommend you listen to that. I think it's like a part one. It's very interesting, quite revealing, maybe too revealing. And so check that out.
Get the juice on Yisha. Well, it's early days.
It's actually my mom and her story and really coming out of the Soviet Union and all that. So that's very interesting. That's plug number one. Plug number two, of course, is for the Land of Israel Network, including Rabbi Mike's other show here called The Jewish Story, which I am an absolute fan of and listen to every week. And we're in the Holocaust right now, the Heart of Darkness.
Yeah, there's the next coming is the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising.
Okay, so that's going to be very interesting, hard listening, but fun in that it's knowledgeable. Okay, but in any case, it is certainly intellectual and deep, and thank you very much. I also want to thank the good people at Tchelet, T-E-K-H-E-L-E-T, for the True Blue Jew String. Go to Tchelet.com and get your own and be part of the Tchelet revolution in the great time that we're living in. Two more announcements, and that is one. This Shabbat is Vayera. The Shabbat afterwards is Parshat Chayei Sarah. And that's when about 30 to 35,000 people are coming to Hebron. I will be there, Bezrat Hashem, amongst the celebrants. Check out the Hebron Fund. Be part of this, witnessing to that Abraham purchased the Tomb of the Patriarchs 3,800 years ago, and our nation is back there today. That's a very special thing. And last announcement for me, maybe you have one, is that I will be traveling to New York and Toronto right after Parshat Chayei Sarah. If you are interested in seeing me, please write me an email, yisha@thelandofisrael.com, or if you're interested in hosting some kind of gig, I will be in New York for a few days, and then immediately afterwards to Big T.O. and visiting the fabulous Jewish community there and connecting them to the land of Israel. So that's my announcements. You have anything?
No.
Okay, good. Okay, perfect. All right, let's finish up by saying, guess what? Good news. Isaac is saved at the end, although, interestingly enough...
Spoiler alert.
Although you should know that the Zohar says, no, he was. He, in fact, his soul left his body and was shot back in by God. This reminds me of the receiving of the Torah at Sinai, where the Jews kind of died and were resuscitated, spiritually resuscitated. So too, Isaac is kind of like he leaves this heavenly abode. He never leaves the land of Israel, but yep, his soul does leave his body and goes kind of to heaven, gets shot back down. And Abraham is told, and here's the operative phrase here, do not stretch your hand out against the lad, nor do anything to him, for now I know that you are a God-fearing man, since you have not withheld your son, your only one, from me. Okay, so kind of, you know, withholding something that is this world belong to us, can you withhold anything from God? But it's a posture that I return everything that I have back to the Lord. And then the ram is caught in the thicket by its horns. Have you ever seen a ram caught in the thicket by its horns? Such an improbable thing. And I sense that there's more here. What is the ram and what is the caught by the thicket of its horns? Like, there's no really way to catch a ram in nature. It has to be caught somehow so that you can catch it. There's no way that Abraham...
You're just going to wrestle this ram to the ground?
You can't do it, you know what I mean? So
certainly
so,
not if you're 99.
So nature...
Or 100 and something.
Right, like it's though the earth or nature itself has caught this ram, or maybe this is a prelude maybe to the burning bush. Something in nature itself is helping or is part of the story.
Well, it's interesting that the Midrash sees it in the opposite, that the ram was running toward Avraham to basically save Yitzchak, and it was the Satan that made it hang up in the bushes.
Oh.
Yeah, that Satan, he can't get him out of this story.
He's there.
Oh, yeah.
He's there. By the way, last week, remember we talked about the vulture and I said, like, shoo away the vulture, keep mm-hmm. concentrating?
Sure.
The Rashi says that vulture is King David, who wants to, the Messiah, who wants to destroy the nations that hate Israel. But yep. But Abraham's like, it's not time yet.
Mm.
Okay? So it's like kind of the opposite. Any case, last thing is that Abraham is saved. The Temple Mount is proclaimed the special place. An angel comes down to a second time to Abraham and he says,
gets the big blessing.
Get the big blessing that your children are going to be both like the stars and the sand. And a very important phrase, I think, which is Vayirash Zarecha et Sha'ar Oivav, your seed will inherit the gate of their enemies. And my chiddush is that Samson later on is actually going to bring the gate of the enemies on his shoulders to the forefathers and mothers. And finally, very finally, is there's going to be, after this whole thing is done, and maybe Sarah dies at hearing, maybe the Medrash tells us she got, you know, this she was,
but she heard word that her only son was almost killed by his father
didn't
give up the ghost.
She didn't feel She didn't feel so good about that. But good news, everybody, good news. After these things, it was told to Abraham that Milcah had borne children to Nahor, your brother, and there's a list, and Bethuel begot Rebekah.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. Not only is your son Isaac alive,
but his future wife.
But his future wife
is online.
That's right. She has been born, and things shall progress with the help of God. Progress, and the story, the Jewish story,
shall continue.
Rabbi Mike Foyer, this was an extra long show. I want to thank you so much for dealing with the moral challenges of this Torah portion and the getting through them and not being unafraid to tackle them. And so too in our day. We got some moral challenges facing us, and this nation is going to have to use this Torah to help us have the courage to do the right thing, to be strong, to be kind, and also to be just, and to do things in God's and Abraham's footprints.
Amen.
Amen. God bless you, Rabbi Mike Foyer. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
Stay tuned. We have more here on the Yishai Fleischer Show. A few more minutes with something also very moving, and I'm going to save the name of what that moving thing is. For the segment to actually happen, because it has to happen. So I don't know if it's going to happen, so it has to happen. But stay tuned, and you'll be part of that. Just a few more minutes here on the Yishai Fleischer Show. Thank you so much for being with us. Of course, if you finished to this part, write me hashtag
I made it.
Moral victory. That's what I want to hear. Hashtag moral victory. Again, Rabbi Mike Foyer at RavMike@thelandofisrael.com. Thank you very much, and Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Josh Haston here, host of Israel Uncensored on the Land of Israel Radio Network at thelandofisrael.com. Make sure you check out my show every Monday, bringing you the news unfiltered and uncensored, information that you are not getting anywhere else, especially not in the mainstream media.
Israel Uncensored with Josh Haston on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
All right, folks, welcome back to the Yishai Fleischer Show. This half is not going to be so easy, but it's an important one. And let me tell you a story. On the morning of the 18th of November, 2014, Arab men from Jerusalem, from an Arab neighborhood in Jerusalem, entered the Kehillat B'nai Torah synagogue in the Har Nof neighborhood of Jerusalem, Israel. They attacked the praying congregants with axes, knives, and a gun. They killed four dual nationality worshippers, meaning to say U.S. Israeli, and I think it's also a Brit, and critically wounded a responding Druze Israeli police officer who later was killed by those wounds, died from those wounds. They also injured seven male worshippers, one of whom never woke up from a coma and died 11 months later, and that's exactly who we're going to talk about today. It's the story of Rabbi Howard Chaim Rotman. And this was the deadliest terror attack in Jerusalem since the Merkaz Arav massacre in 2008. The attack was one of the a number of violent attacks on Israelis in the summer and autumn of 2014. And it was a kind of small intifada, or called also the Knife Intifada. And if you remember, the story of the Har Nof massacre was such that the pictures that came out were incredibly shocking, because of the ferociousness, the violence, and the kind of knifing of men in prayer was particularly gruesome. At approximately 7 in the morning during a weekday shacharit, the morning prayers, the worshippers were saying the silent Amida prayer, the 18 benedictions prayer. These two Arab men entered the synagogue and, as I mentioned before, attacked them with knives. And the people who were killed were American-Israeli Rabbi Moshe Twersky, head of the Torat Moshe Kollel, son of the famous Harvard professor Rabbi Isidore Twersky, and part of the Boston Rabbinical Dynasty, Rabbi Kalman Levine, and Rabbi Aryeh Kupinski, and British-Israeli Rabbi Avram Shmuel Goldberg. These first four resided in Har Nof, and also Master Sergeant Zidan Saif, the Druze police officer who was shot in the head during the attack and rescue response later died from his wounds. He lived in the North Israeli Druze village of Yanut Jat. Seven other male worshippers were wounded in the attack too seriously. One of the injured victims, as I said before, Howard Chaim Rotman, spent almost a year in a vegetative coma due to the multiple cleaver wounds to the face and head. He died of his wounds on the 23rd of October, 2015. I was speaking at a women's conference on writing, and I met there Risa Rotman, who authored a book in the Art Scroll series, and it is called Terror and Emuna, which means faith, in Harnof. And since we're coming right up to the Yahrzeit, the day of passing of her husband, Rabbi Rotman, I thought that it would be appropriate to have a discussion with her and about her book. Risa, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, let's get to the gruesome part, which is tell me about what that day was like for you. It's early morning, you got kids, you're sending them to school and all that.
Right. So at 7 o'clock in the morning, I was finishing my own morning prayers, and I heard ambulances very distinctly and wondered why they were so distinct so early in the morning. But I pushed the thought aside, and I went on with my morning tasks. At 7:10, I got a phone call from my husband's chavrusa's wife, who said, "I heard they're shooting in the shul. Is Chaim all right?" And I was like, "Oh, rumors." I didn't take it seriously. I went on with the morning and did not connect it to the sound of the ambulances. Another five, 10 minutes later, my newly married son called me and said, "Mommy, I heard there's something going on in the shul, and they won't let me go out, and I don't know what's going on." And I tried calling Abba, and Abba didn't answer. I said, "Abba doesn't answer the phone in the synagogue, and there's no cell reception there anyway." So, and again, I didn't connect the dots, didn't think too deeply into this. I thought it was all rumors, because these things, rumors like these do happen. And I'm the type of person that just doesn't like to think bad things happen. But I did start to get nervous, so I went out to the street to see what I could see, and I could see
Now, the shul is down the street, just a few buildings away.
It's a few buildings across the street from me. So there was a barricade between my building and the actual shul area. I asked people if they knew what happened to my husband, and nobody would respond to me. And while I was up there, my kids called me and said, "I was in the hospital." They were so upset, they didn't even know which hospital their father was in. So I turned to saw Mrs. Goldberg standing there, also not knowing what's going on. Her husband was one of the people murdered. And I gave her a hug and said, "I have to go." Spontaneously, I gave her a hug and said, "I have to go home. They said my husband's in the hospital." And then I ran home, and I was trying to figure out what to do with the kids and take care of them and get them to the neighbors. They were like half-dressed. And figure out what to do about phones so that I shared a cell phone at that point, and that there would be a way for people to call the house and call me and straighten that all out. And then I went with my married son and his wife down to her parents lived in the neighborhood also, and they drove us to the hospital. We didn't even know which hospital we were going to until the kids called us and said, "The hospital called again, and you have to go to Adassa and Karim." And that's when I finally sunk in and I started to cry. Because if he had been injured, if he wasn't such a serious injury, then they would have taken him to Shaar Tzedek, the closest hospital. But Hadassah is known for the one that they take the most serious injuries. So, and that's when I started realizing this was serious and something real happened.
Mm-hmm. And when was the first time you saw your husband?
Oh, gosh. We got to the hospital, let's say 9 o'clock, I don't even know, maybe even 8:30. And we were received by this hospital social worker who described my husband's injuries to us and the surgeries that were taking place. And we were put in a big conference room with the two other families with very seriously injured men. And then the members of the family and other social service people started joining us through the day as we waited and waited and waited through the surgeries. We didn't see him till 7-8 o'clock at night because they were waiting with the surgeries. And even when we did see him, he was all draped up because the injuries were to the head. We almost saw nothing of his face. And then I just crashed in the hospital. Like somebody found me a bed in a family room, and I just fitfully slept.
Did you already know that the other men were murdered? Was it already all clear to you what was going on in the rest of the families that were
doing
that?
As the day wore on, I got name, not each name together. I got each name separately. Also because, I don't know why, but the police didn't report to the people what was happening to their family members. So I saw people coming into the hospital looking around, trying to find their family. So one, I was actually very closely connected to the other families. Particularly the Kupinski family, who I used to spend time in their house as a young teenager. Mm-hmm. And I saw his brother in the hospital. So I went over later to somebody else and I said, what's the story with Kupinski? And at first she didn't answer me. And then she came back to me and she said, I have to tell you this. And she told me, revealed to me. And that was the first person I found out who passed away. And I, if I wasn't hysterical beforehand, became more. And as the day went by, another name came, another name. Until finally, Levine, the last name I learned about, and also somebody my family was really, really close to. Our kids grew up together. At that point, I was so hysterical, I couldn't even talk, cry anymore.
And Harnoff is an ultra-Orthodox community, a lot of Anglos as well. And people know one another here. It's a kind of place that people kind of know each other.
Well, Agassiz Street, it's big. It's hard enough, not little, tiny. Agassiz Street, Anglos, there's a tendency to know each other. But ironically, the of those people that were three out of the four original murdered men, I personally was so close to. Mrs. Goldberg, she had gone to England and come back the day of my son's wedding, 10 weeks before the attack. And she said to me, and she got off the plane, went home, got dressed, and came to my son's wedding. And she said to me, Risa, 10 weeks before the attack, Risa, I just came back from London. It's just so full of Arabs. We're so much safer here.
In Eretz Israel.
In Eretz Israel.
Mm-hmm. All right. You also started telling me a story before we went on the recording here. You started telling me a story about the Kotel.
Not about the Kotel, about all the things that led up to the attack. So my son's bar mitzvah was Gimel Tam, was 3 months before the attack. And we went to take him to the Kotel, and there was terrible crying. And when we came back and finished, my husband told me that they just found the three kidnapped boys. And of course, I was very, very hysterical about that too. And then the next night, my older son got engaged. But it was a very strange night because the helicopters were flying all around Harnof, right next to Harnof, the whole. It was weird. And we found out that they were looking because an Arab child from the old city was, from the eastern Jerusalem, was kidnapped and murdered. And he dumped in the forest below Harnof. And that was the start of the Gaza war, Tzuk Eitan. So that, for some strange reason, I was never so connected to any Israeli war as I was that one. I cried every single day. I was a nervous wreck. And the war ended, and my son got married. And like I said, 10 weeks later, there was the attack, and it was sort of understood that the attack on Harnof was like retaliation for this kidnapped boy. So I felt like maybe like there was something inside me, my inner soul, understood that this war was going to have an effect, and all those events were going to have an effect, affect me personally very deeply somehow.
Mm-hmm. Right. So let's talk a little bit about the events around it, which is also the ultra-Orthodox men here are oftentimes not armed. Okay, so the folks here don't have kind of a way to shoot back. And who ended up kind of stopping this attack from getting further perpetrated was this Druze police officer.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about that end of the story.
That end, that he was murdered. He was a traffic policeman. he heard the call and he just came with tremendous like strength and mightiness. He just came to be there, and he, I think he managed to murder it. He managed to stop one of the terrorists, but a bullet went into his head, and he later died of his wounds. Mm-hmm. I have met his wife several times in events around the attack.
Your husband, maybe there was a hope that he would recover consciousness, but it never did happen.
The hope was very, very, very small.
Why is that?
'Cause nobody knew, and the doctors wanted to be as optimistic about the whole thing as possible. He suffered tremendous injuries to his brain, and there was a huge stroke over the brainstem. Mm-hmm. But the doctor said we can never know with the brain. A brain is very plastic. So they wanted to keep all doors open. But we had to be a little bit realistic. Now, my husband was about a month in the ICU. And then after that, he was in neurosurgery in Adassa and Kerem. And we felt like we were beginning to see some signs of consciousness. But at the same time, he started infections. Continuous series of infections, one kind or another. And it's my theory, and I didn't really discuss it with the medical personnel, but it was my theory that his body was working so hard to fight the infections that he didn't have the kawakta, the energy to rise above the unconsciousness.
Now, I see that you have, how many children do you have today? We don't count them?
I gave birth
quite a bit.
I gave birth to 11 children. Unfortunately, one's no longer alive. Mm-hmm.
So 10 children are alive.
10 children are alive.
Baruch Hashem.
Yeah.
Now I see one of your daughters here. Tell me a little bit about like how, in the wake of all this, they're growing up. They're continuing their life. Where are they drawing strength from?
I think they draw strength from each other. I think they draw strength from the community at large. Our personal community that was so supportive, and the worldwide Jewish community that was incredibly supportive to us during that year and beyond. I think that they derived certain strength from their father himself, who was personally a very, very strong person.
In what sense?
So as I said, I have a child that passed away. My oldest son fell when he was 17 years old. He fell off a cliff. He was out biking in the forest, and from what we understand, he got off the bike and he fell down. Nobody was with him, so we don't know. And of course, it was a huge tragedy to all of us, but he sort of led us in his strength and accepting this was Hashem's will.
Hmm. So you think that kind of attitude continued to percolate down to the children?
I do feel that way, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's also... Well, one thing I've noticed about you in general through reading through this book, and then my wife read every page, I skimmed more through it, but I definitely stopped in a lot of places and looked at it. One of the things I noticed is that you have an incredible memory, an incredible recall. were you able to just remember everything, or did you write stuff down? Did you have a sense, you know, initially that you were going to write a book on this? The book is called Ter Emun and Emuna in Har Nof, A Year of Growth and Faith. It's the kind of book that my wife Malka always reads because... This is a hard book, but it's filled also with stories that kind of make you feel stronger and come out a little bit. You see life in perspective, and you get a little bit stronger through it. And that's the name of the book as well. Tell me, how did you go about writing this book?
Truthfully, a few people kept telling me, write your experiences. One social worker said, write it because you're going to fill in all the empty spaces for your husband when he wakes up from the coma. Mm-hmm. Somebody else just wanted me to do it because that's what she encourages people to write down their experiences. I couldn't write that whole year. I couldn't pick up a pen and start writing. But I did. I had incredible recall to all the events right after, because I started writing the book a month after my husband passed away.
Because you have like little stories and just little things and some, you know, very interesting things that, for example, what is it like to be in the hospital with Arab patients, for example, and sitting in a waiting room with other like Arab people and how to feel about that vis-a-vis modern Israel, vis-a-vis the fact that your husband, you know, was murdered by a heinous jihadist attack. And such stories of kind of like how the doctors and talked with you and how you deal with nitty gritty things. It's not broad strokes. It's actually small strokes that you remembered little details.
So again, so it was that because I wrote it, started writing right within that right away period after the attack, it was all very fresh in my mind. I didn't write anything down. It was all very fresh in my mind. And it was recently we commented that if I would have gone to do it now, I couldn't have done it in such detail. I don't have my sort of brain shut down since then. And I have to go back and read the book and
see. I understand. Tell me about since the attack in the community. Have there been changes in consciousness? Now, you and I, we live in somewhat different social constructs around us. And I remember that I heard during that time, certainly not everybody, but there were phrases that were said that were like, you know, hey, we're the ultra-Orthodox. We're not in the land conflict. We're not in the issues. We're unarmed. We don't go to the army. Why attack us? I mean, there were a few people who said phrases like this. I remember that very well. I mean, I want to tell you that one of the reasons I'm here today is because this attack was an attack that there's been many attacks since and before, but it was particularly poignant. It was clear that this was an attack on the Jewish people, on rabbis, on learned people, on people in prayer. And there were images of blood mixed in with tefillin. It was very evocative of the Holocaust and that kind of imagery. And also it underscored also some differences in philosophy between the ultra-Orthodox world and other parts of Israeli society. So tell me a little bit about that. Like, has there been any change in consciousness? How have people dealt with it theologically or politically or sociologically here in Har-Nof?
Okay, in Har-Nof, I think that the emphasis has been, and it's a tremendous thing, on Achdus, on the community,
unity.
Seeing each other, the community seeing each other as a whole and not in fractions. There's one incredible woman, her name is Esther Yarmish, and that's what she does. She built this whole thing called Project Connect to bring the women of the neighborhood together for all different kinds of activities, and it's not relevant because even though Har-Nof is maybe primarily ultra-Orthodox, there is a Dati Lumi community.
Religious Zionist.
And to bring everyone together.
In fact, there's
together.
A shul here called the Religious Zionist Shul.
Right. And it's to be inclusive and not exclusive to everyone. And I think that there is that sense in Har-Nof that we owe it to ourselves and to the Jewish world at large that we are connected to one another. We need each Jew needs another Jew and to be tolerant and loving to one another. So if there was any kind of change in consciousness, I think that was the understood value by every Har-Nof person that we wanted to reach.
What about theologically?
Theologically, my own theology is that no matter what, we're in God's hands, and He is the master director of everything that's going on. We have to do what we have to do as people, in whatever way that is. But no matter what, the plan is His. It's His master plan.
Okay, and what about defense-wise? Have things changed in your mind or in the synagogue's mind? You know, are people, is there an armed guard? Is there more of that sense that's part of the equation?
I don't think in our shul. I never heard that. I could be wrong. Sometimes maybe they do bring in guard for special events. Mm-hmm. If that's like the choice of the people. Mm-hmm. They had already started something called HaShomer in Har-Nof. It was more because of like there's a lot of break-ins to people's houses and things like that. And I think that the community as a whole stood behind that program maybe more, and they were able to fund it better because mm-hmm. people saw a different, newer, more necessary need. There were discussions about every shul needing somebody who was armed. I don't know if it really anybody went with that. I don't think in Kilat B'nai Torah, our synagogue, that happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes a lot of sense, or at least I understand that. You know, if somebody would come into the shul of Hebron, you know, they'd be Swiss cheese in a little bit of time. And here, you know, this meat cleaver thing. What about your relationship to Arabs and to the consciousness of why these two young men who I haven't spoken about, who are residents of Israel, lived in Jabal Mukaber, which is a neighborhood of Jerusalem, and worked here at Harnof and were familiar with Harnof and people who made their living, you know, from Israel, from Jews, who knew perfectly well who to target, who understood exactly who they were targeting and how relatively defenseless they were going to be. What's your relationship to that?
It's a crazy thing. Every time we talk about a certain kind of profession in Israel, so somebody will suddenly say, everybody works in that today is an Arab. If you talk about pharmacists or fixing cell phones or whatever, it's inevitable. We can't get away from them. Our lives are enmeshed with theirs. And my husband always used to say, be respectful and suspect. So I think that is my way of going through things. It's inevitable that you're going to cross paths with Arab people. I feel that I should be respectful towards them, but I can't say that I trust them.
Okay, let's I guess end off with here you are now, you're a widow, and there's a difference between somebody who's a widow or a widower from a heart attack or from whatever, and there's a difference between that and violent crime. It's just a different thing. And you're raising these 10, or you've already raised a few of them, but still you're raising a lot of these children. Tell me about how you see the future. Where do you hope to go? Where do you hope to get to? With them, with yourself, I don't know, with your book.
It's a day-by-day process, really, more than anything else. I was leading up with the book. I also did a very big renovation job, and the book was coming out.
You renovated your house?
Completely, from head to toe. So my mind was very busy with that. Sort of came to the end of both these two big projects, and it's like a question, okay, so I was very distracted with that, and now it's a question of where will I go? And I asked that to myself, too. I'm not quite sure. I'll let you know when I know.
Risa Rotman is the author of Terror and Emunah in Harnof. Harnof, by the way, means Mount of View. And there's a beautiful view out here. This is the western edge of Jerusalem, right on the Jerusalem forest. Something very peaceful about this place, something very beautiful. It is, when you walk in the streets here, you realize immediately that this is a religious, observant community, deeply so. The Torah is a huge part of life here. That's really what is the underpinning of life here. And there's a great air, and there's kind of wonderful views from the apartments here. At the same time, that peacefulness was broken on that day, and the pieces are being put back together by very strong people. Terror and Emunah in Harnof, put out by the Art Scroll series. Risa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for coming.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show. Thank you so much for being with us. If you want to write Risa an email, you could do it through me. I'll send her an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. And we can all draw strength from people who are continuing to show strength and heroism and courage through challenge. And also the spirit of Rabbi Rotman, who is no longer with us, and the other victims. They died sanctifying God's name, and we should live to sanctify God's name. Thanks so much for being with me, folks. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. Be part of the story wherever you are. God bless you, and shalom.
Martyrdom does not end something, said Indira Gandhi. It is only a beginning. And for me, each episode is a new beginning, because I'm telling a story of the past set to build a present identity that's motivated to make the future of which we dream. I'm Rav Mike Foyer, and this is The Jewish Story.
Listen to The Jewish Story with Rav Mike Foyer.
on thelandofisrael.com.